Well, hi, everybody. My name is Bill. As a matter of fact, it's Bill Wilson. And I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Bill.
And as Dale has just told you, I'm a different kind of an alcoholic. You know, an Irish alcoholic really is different from every other kind. You better get that straight from the start. Totally different. And the main difference is this. When an Irishman becomes an alcoholic, he doesn't have to learn a damn thing about all that is involved in being an alcoholic. He's to learn nothing, doesn't need to learn anything about stinking thinking, bullshitting, only they call it blarney over there. He's to the manor born. The kind of thing I mean is, I was on my vacation over there a couple of years ago, and I was saying mass in a little country church down in the south of Ireland one Sunday morning, just like this morning. The church is at the bottom of a mountain in the most beautiful part of Ireland, among the lakes of Killarney. And after mass, I was talking to the people outside church, and they all disappeared eventually, except one guy who had been staying apart, not socializing in any way. I suppose he'd been about 22 or 23. Typical farmer's son, would probably never see any more of the world in all his life than that little area he was living in there. And I went over to him, started to talk to him, tried to draw him out. And I don't know what got into me, but the mood of that morning, with the sunlight on the lakes and all the beautiful wildflowers, the waterfalls and the mountains. Gosh, you could believe in anything looking at it all. It was like magic. And I said to this guy eventually, when I did get him to open up a little bit, I said to him, Pat, will you tell me now for real, do you believe in leprechauns? Really? Well, you know, I should tell you that he'd have come from a background that I was very familiar with. He would have been told when he was going to school, probably to the nuns, and learning his catechism, that all superstitious beliefs are against the law of God. And I said to him, now really tell me, do you really believe in the leprechaun? He said, oh, no, Father. Then he looked at me. But they're there, all right. That's an Irishman. And that guy hadn't even started drinking yet. I was born in a little village in the south of Ireland, and I had the same brainwashing and upbringing that everyone has in a little village where everybody is Roman Catholic. I went to the nuns when I was a child, to school, went from there to the religious brothers, I went from there to the what are called the classical school, which was run by the clergy. And in the little village in Ireland, the church building is the focal point of everything that goes on. So I come from a background where, to put it at its mildest, I got an awful lot of God. Now I want to tell you that what I was told and what I heard wasn't always the same. And I got the idea from as far back as I can remember that the only worthwhile thing to do in this world is to fulfill what the good book says. The good book tells us what's called the first and the greatest of all the commandments. The biggest, biggest thing a human being can do, most important, it's to love God. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart, thy whole soul, thy whole mind. That is the first and the greatest thing of all. That's the biggest, biggest thing a human being can do. That's bigger than becoming a millionaire. That's bigger than getting to the moon and back. That is the greatest thing a human being can do. And little Bill Wilson made his mind up from as far back as I can remember that I was going to do just that, and to heck with everything else. Now don't forget, what I was told and what I heard wasn't always the same thing. When I asked myself, what does this business of loving God with your whole heart really mean? What do you have to do that? I got the idea that whatever else you had to do, one thing was certain. You had to make yourself as miserable as a human being could be. You had to deny yourself, you had to afflict yourself, you had to be self-sacrificing and do penance, and the goodies would all come at the end, but in between, you'd better sweat it out. That's loving God. So, I said, okay, if that's what it's to be, so be it. I made my mind up I was going to be a priest. But I wasn't going to be just any ordinary kind of priest. I was going in for an honors course in this business of loving God. I had found out there were different kinds of priests, and that there were types of priests who went to live in monasteries where they fasted, where they slept on straw and on planks, where they got up in the middle of the night, break their sleep at 2 o'clock in the morning to sing the praises of God, where they really made themselves thoroughly miserable. And I was going to go for that. I also heard that if you really wanted to go the whole hog altogether, then you would leave home, you'd leave your possessions, your family, you'd leave all kinds of comforts, and you'd go way, way out to convert the heathen. And where in all this world could you get more heathen than England? So, at the ripe age of 15 and a half, I packed my little bag. I said goodbye to my mother and father and my only other relative, a brother. That was all there was to our family. I don't know what was going on. It's not typically Irish, I know. Anyway. And went to cross the sea to England, where I first of all went to a special school that was run by this monastery, and in due course I became a monk in the monastery. And my life was what I had expected it to be, but in a strange way, it was a happy life. You know, I didn't know it then. I know it now. But it was you that taught me this. What all that austerity and penance and self-sacrificing of the monks in that monastery, what all that was all about was smashing ego. I didn't know that then. That's all it's all about. If you really want to get close to God or let God get close to you, ego has to be smashed. I know that now. It was you that taught it to me. Well, I lived that life, and I was in due course ordained a priest. And when I was 30, now that was 5 years after I was ordained a priest, I was 30 in the year 1950, and that was 5 years after the Second World War ended in Europe. And Europe began to get back to being halfway normal, and the religious outfit that I belonged to resumed a practice that had been going on for centuries, but had been interrupted by the war. All the religious orders, the Catholic Church all over the world, as well as the dioceses, that means the outfits where there's regular priests looking after the people in parishes. There's a long-standing practice whereby the more talented guys among them are picked out and sent to Rome, to a Roman university, study all kinds of highfalutin stuff. And, I don't know what had become of this whole business of loving God with my whole heart, but I decided anyway, a life in the upper echelons, where you're recognized as a brilliant man, wouldn't be at all undesirable. So I started pulling wires and manipulating, and I got myself sent to Rome to study. And I found myself in a big, big monastery, which was the headquarters of this worldwide religious order, along with other monks from all over the world, as well as the resident Italians. And we all went to the various universities we're supposed to go to. This was the beginning of my drinking career. Twice a day, the community assembled in the biggest room in the monastery, which was what they called the refectory. That's the old name for the dining room. And there were these wooden tables all around, no tablecloths, very, very old, very, very dark and austere. But all down the middle of these tables were enormous flagons of wine. One was positioned between each of two monks. You weren't supposed to drink at all, but they were always there, you know. And, you always had the same guy either side of you, because you always went according to seniority, like in your, like in the service. Now, the fellow who sat beside me, with whom I was supposed to share this huge flagon of wine, used to pour himself out that much, and all the rest was left. The guy the other side of me, who shared one with a guy beyond him, never took any at all. He was weird. And the guy beyond him, just that much. So twice a day, for 3 hilarious years, I had 2 enormous flagons of wine. I got up from every meal tacking against the wind. This was my first ever experience of intoxication. I want you to know, God, I loved it. I never had any idea in my life that there was such a dimension to reality. But my intake, as time went on there, my intake in the refectory became just openers. Because in the community there were a crowd of English-speaking guys, like from America, Ireland, like myself, England, Australia, the English-speaking ones. And we formed a little clique. We weren't supposed to, but we did. Did you ever try to live with Italians talking Italian all day? Anyway, We formed a little clique of our own, and of course we all had money sent to us by our bosses back home to buy books and the university and all the usual expenses. And we got more than was needed, don't you understand? So, we laid in a regular supply. And these guys, I don't know how this came about, these guys elected me the bartender. And my room, by the way, in a monastery, you don't call it a room, it's a cell. As some of you may be familiar with that. But my cell was the bar. I kept all the hoosh. I remember I had a row of shelves with all the hoosh and the bottles there, discreetly hidden by a blanket. I remember we reached a stage where we co-opted one Italian into the group because we had found out that this guy's family owned a winery. And this guy's father secreted it through the back door of the monastery and up the stairs, a whole barrel of wine. And this was installed in my cell. Well, I want to tell you that those first 3 years of my experience of alcohol were the honeymoon years. I never enjoyed life in all my life like I did then. It was unbelievable. I don't remember very much of it. I have odd wisps of recall. I can see myself now sitting on the floor in the big broad hallway leading from my cell to the bathroom at about 4 o'clock in the morning, just sitting there, giggling, that's all. That was life in those first 3 years for me. I don't know how in the name of God I got my degree. By the way, I love name dropping. There was a man in the same class as myself in the university I went to that you've all heard of by now. He's known to the whole human race now as John Paul II. There was a time when I used to say, the Pope went to school with me. I don't say that anymore. But you see, he imbibed the same wisdom that I did, and look at where it got him. There's never been an Irish one yet. Anyway, I came home loaded with knowledge. Now, I want you all to understand that you'll never appreciate my story unless you get this firmly into your head. I am an exceptionally brilliant man. Now, will you get that straight? You'll never understand the rest of this story. I came home, meant my monastery in England. And I was put teaching the young men who would be the future priests of this religious order. And I undertook this task with the greatest zeal, self-satisfaction. But I want to tell you that I discovered that I couldn't function without the bottle. I found out that I needed it. I became a closet drinker. Now, to get the hang of this, you might be mystified if you know anything about what a Catholic monk, a priest who's also a monk, what it's like. The difference between an ordinary priest like you have out there in the parishes and a monk, the difference is that a monk takes certain vows. Takes a vow of poverty, never to own any money, never to own anything at all, to live as a poor man The same way that Jesus Christ himself did. It takes of our obedience, never to run his own life or make his own choices, to be subject to the authority of another human being for the love of God. And he also takes of our what's called chastity. Less said, the better. Now, you might be mystified how a monk living in a monastery can manage to have his bottle all the time. Well, I want to tell you guys something. I learned how to live a day at a time long before I came here. There are ways and means. One of the things I should tell you is that religious order engaged in a kind of work that some of you might be familiar with. The men of that order would leave their monastery at certain intervals at the invitation of the regular priests running the parishes out there. And those regular priests would invite one, two, or three of these kind of men from these monasteries to come to the parish, preach for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. The people would crowd the churches. That was the theory of the thing. And it's supposed to be like Moses coming down from communing with God on the mountain, coming down to his people and telling them, thus saith the Lord. And of course, when you go out on those jobs, you'd meet people who were very kind to you and all that. I never came back without the necessary in the bag, don't you understand? And sometimes you'd get a backhander and you'd save it up and you'd keep the supply going. There was no problem. I was teaching, and at this time, something happened in the Catholic Church that some of you might have heard of. There was a general council, which was the first one for many, many, many years, called the Second Vatican Council. And this thing was called by the Pope of the time to bring about the updating or modernizing and renewal of the whole Catholic Church. Did I tell you I was a very brilliant man? Well, you see, I knew all about that. I had studied all that in depth, don't you understand? And some of the old-timers in the religious order I belong to didn't get the message at all. They didn't know what all this renewal stuff was all about. They were a pack of stupid dolts, don't you understand? Well, I wasn't teaching very long when I led a revolution. I organized the students and the young priests in the community. I told them that all the old ways that all those fuddy-duddies were standing for had to go. And all we had to do was close ranks, get behind me. And we'll beat them. Well, the phone wires were burning between the monastery I was living in and headquarters. I remember overhearing the boss saying on the phone, "He's at it again." After occupying the chair of theology in the monastery for 4 months, the big chief came along, called me to his office, and fired me. Did I tell you I was a very brilliant man? Fired me! Did you hear that? And I remember him sitting there looking at me and saying, "You know, the worst day's work I ever did was send you to Rome to study, because all it did for you was it made you an alcoholic." I couldn't believe my ears. I'll never forget that guy saying to me, "All it did for you was it made you an alcoholic." Well, I came out of his office and I met some of the guys in the hallway and I said,
You won't believe what that jackass has just said to me. My God. Just because I enjoy a drink or two. I'm an alcoholic. Otter. This is insane. Pack my bags. Transfer to another monastery that they owned out in the boondocks, where there wasn't a pub for about 50 miles. I cooled my heels there for some time, and for the next 25 years, my life was difficult to describe. 25 years in which I carried a king-sized resentment on my shoulder. 25 years in which I was constantly drinking with no faintest realization that drinking had anything to do with anything. God's sakes, nothing to do with anything. 25 years in which I was reduced in the ranks and I was given the job to do that you needed no brains to do. The ordinary job of any ordinary hack. Did I tell you I was a very brilliant man? I was the kind of guy who would be ready to buttonhole you at any hour of the day or night and start telling you, you won't believe what that gang of thugs did to me. A brilliant man with a future in the world of academia, who'd be able to put right everything that was wrong with the Roman Catholic Church if the bastards would only listen. Kicked me out. Kicked me out of the world of scholarship. And the work I was supposed to do was the ordinary work of going around the parishes and also giving retreats, what's called retreats, to other religious communities like religious sisters, nuns, religious brothers. And there I was, talking what I call the subliminaries, talking about the real life of total devotedness to God. And all the time I knew that I had become myself, because I had become an utterly undesirable type of character. I'd become obnoxious, arrogant, proud. I'd become jealous of everybody. I had become a mass of lust. I want to tell you, I don't know if I'm telling you anything you don't know, I can only share with you what I found out. When that stuff starts coursing through your bloodstream, all kinds of urges are let loose. And when those urges are suddenly discovered and are let loose, after you've passed adolescence and all that good stuff, oh boy, there can be volcanic eruptions, I'm telling you. And I know what the big book is talking about when it talks about pitiable and incomprehensible demoralization. I was leading a contemptible type of life. I went in for a kind of substitute sexual experiences, substitute ones, all that old shameful damn nonsense that's unsatisfying, that's meaningless, that's contemptible. I sought the kind of places, company, that was no credit to any human being, any human. And all that was going on, and at the same time I was a man of utter violent temper. Utterly incontrollable. Totally incontrollable. I was sitting in the confessional hearing God's humble, simple people acknowledging their character defects, taking a fifth step, trying to articulate, and that forget or get hesitant and get mixed up and I would just explore. Oh, you for God's sake, get on with the business. What the hell are we doing here? I go into a classroom, simple, innocent little children, asking for catechism. Poor little child to get nervous, forget. Another explosion. And all this time, you know, I was doing my duties as a priest every morning, the choir trip. And I'm not going to try to make Roman Catholics of you all, but I just want you to know that a guy in my job believes rightly or wrongly, believes anyway, that when he does what he does at the altar, he's holding the living God himself in his hands. And to be face to face with your Maker at those close quarters, having come from the pigsty, with the sweat and the shakes, it's not a comfortable feeling. Not a comfortable feeling. I knew I had become a bum. I knew I had become a fake, phony. And yet I was afraid to pack it all in and leave altogether. I don't know. Deep, deep down, there was that old boyish ideal still there. All that matters is to love God. I would do something about all this sometime, somehow. Sometime. I would clean up my act, whatever in the world that meant. And I was constantly being moved on. I decided to take a geographic, but the guys I lived with in England didn't appreciate me. And I got the special permission of the supreme authority in the Catholic Church to transfer back to Ireland. The same order had monasteries in Ireland. And I went there and I discovered that Ireland was absolutely sunk in old-fashionedness. They didn't understand. And I made another application. And I pulled more wires. And I took another geographic. This time, further west, young man. And I got somebody to recommend me to the Bishop of San Diego. And I was accepted in the Diocese of San Diego in the year 1968. And my ties with the monastery and with that whole type of life were formally dissolved. But I was just an ordinary priest in a diocese. Needless to say, I brought my problem with me. I was the same arrogant, belligerent, obnoxious, dissatisfied, egomaniacal, impossible person. Dreadfully discontented, dreadfully unhappy, always intending to do something, someday, somehow about it all. It all ended up with a vacation that I had in 1975 in Mexico. I had made friends with a family in San Diego, or they had made friends with me. By the way, I chose my friends very carefully. The wife of this family was related to a dynasty that owned a winery. And they used to have cases and cases and cases of all kinds of wine and champagne and brandy and all kinds of good stuff in their garage. I was never without. Never. And they had a... They had a, what do you call it, a trailer down on the beach in a place called Ensenada. If anybody wants to bottom out, go to Ensenada. And I joined the family down there in the trailer, and my booze was easily accessible all the time. But there was, coming to the end of the vacation, the father and mother had to come back up to San Diego, and that left what I call the kids and myself. Now, the kids range from a college-age son, who was about 22 or 3, right down to little Timmy, who was a 6 or 7 of them. And I was sitting in the trailer, coming towards midnight, I'd been drinking as usual all day, and I poured out the last of the whiskey, threw the bottle away, and got up with my bumper to pass out with. I always had to pass out. I drank to get drunk. What the hell else do you drink for? And I drank to pass out. I stood up and I said to the kids, now it's time for us all to be in our beds. Switch off that radio and let's have a bit of peace and quiet around here. I'm going to bed. I stood up and I staggered across to the door leading into my little corner of the trailer where I had a bunk. And Matt, the eldest son, stood in the doorway, got up, walked over and stood in the doorway, and looked at me. He said, where do you think you're going with that? And he pointed to the glass. I said, I'm going to bed. He said, no, you're not. Not with that. Did I tell you I'm a very brave man? Did you hear the way that little punk spoke to me? I said, who the hell said I'm not? He said, I did. And I'm going to say something else to you that needs to be said more than any other thing on the face of this earth. You think because of the job you're in that you can exploit my family and get all the booze that you want out of my family. I've news for you, buddy, he said. All you are is an ignorant, savage, Irish alcoholic, and you are not welcome around here. I couldn't believe my ears. I said, who the hell do you think you are? He said, a good question. The eldest son of this family. That you think you can use. That's who I think I am. And what I'm telling you about you, my father wants to tell you, but is too damn shy. My mother wants to tell you, and all my brothers and sisters here want to tell you. Because it's the truth about you. Every time you drink, you become totally changed. You're just a barbarian. And it's not for you, that stuff. I shook all over. And he made to get the glass out of my hand. That was the end of the bottle. And he spilled it on the floor. The one I was going to pass out with. And all I can tell you is that right then, something exploded in here in me. And I went for his jugular. And if the others hadn't been there that night, I do believe I would not be here this morning. I'd at least be in jail. I wanted to kill him. I mean that literally. I wanted to. I know what every human being has actually felt like who has laid violent hands on another human being and killed them. I know what they feel like, felt like. I half wrecked that place and I stormed out of there. And there was a restaurant a couple of hundred yards up the beach that was still open. And I got my last bottle of booze there. And I stayed out all night on the beach. That was the 8th September, 1975. Next day, I remember walking the beach and looking out at the ocean. And I remember it dawning on me. My God! You wanted to kill a boy last night. You wanted to. You've come a long way, baby. Long, long way. You know,
I was talking to myself. You're going to do it someday. Or someone is going to do it to you. With the kind of situations you get yourself into. I was terrified. I packed up my belongings. I came back up to San Diego. I had to go to a dentist to keep an appointment. He did his thing, put in the stuff. I was sitting there in the chair. He was out in another room doing something else to some other patient. This is the next day. I was lying in the chair, and I was reading the Sports Illustrated magazine, an account of a round of golf by Jack Nicklaus. And I was no more thinking of what had happened the previous night than I was thinking of what goes on the far side of the moon. Totally absorbed in what I was reading. And totally relaxed. And in a way I will never understand. I can't say I heard a voice. I can't say I saw banner headlines across a screen. But it was like as if I did. A realization came in upon me and held me in an iron grip. The realization, you are an alcoholic. I never had an experience like that, and I feel a fool trying to tell anyone about it. You are an alcoholic. And sitting there, I didn't even remember what that kid had said to me the previous night. I suppose a psychologist could explain it. I don't know. But I became so overwhelmingly aware that I'm an alcoholic.